Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the December 27th reading of The Environment, a compilation of articles from the Nature Conservancy magazine, the magazine of the Sierra Club, Mother Earth News, and a few others. My name is John. Today we'll read this following main article, Here's How to Choose Climate-Friendly Food at the Grocery Store, written by Grace Van Dielen. With remaining time, we'll select articles from participating publications. So, here we go, from the magazine of the Sierra Club, Here's How to Choose Climate-Friendly Food at the Grocery Store, a guide to eating in a warming world that goes beyond Meatless Monday, written by Grace Van Dielen. Even if we consider ourselves environmentally minded, lowering carbon emissions by swapping animal products for a plant-based diet remains off the table for a lot of people. In many cultures, there are strongly ingrained beliefs that help people rationalize their meat consumption, said Matthew Ruby, a senior lecturer in psychology at La Trobe University in Australia, who studies why people make certain food choices. The top justifications for consuming animal products are the four N's, believing they're nice to eat, necessary for health, and normal and natural dietary choices. But the four N's do not necessarily hold up to scrutiny. Plant-based foods can be just as tasty and nutritious, and humans are continuously adapting to their environments. It's possible for us to gastronomically adapt to a warming world, too. Here's how you can start making choices with our global food system and climate change in mind. The most well-known way to become a flexible eater is by adopting Meatless Monday, the practice of avoiding all meat on the first day of the work week. It's a low-commitment entry point with a potentially high payoff. About a third of Meatless Monday participants become fully vegetarian after 5 years. It might be even cheaper. Research suggests that a vegetarian diet can reduce food spending by as much as 30%. To add a pound of body weight, livestock need to eat anywhere from 2 to 50 times as many pounds of feed, often containing commodity crops such as corn or soybeans. That means every calorie from meat amplifies emissions across the farming system. It's far more efficient for us to eat plants directly than to eat the animals those plants feed. While giving up meat once a week won't stop the system in its tracks, voting with your dollars can work in the long term to prevent a lot of pollution, and already is. Two-thirds of consumers plan to spend more money on plant-based products in the future, and large meat conglomerates such as Tyson Foods and Smithfield Foods are bending to market pressures, rolling out plant-based meat alternatives while closing some of their large meat processing plants. If you typically eat meat 2 times a day, replacing it with meatless options such as tofu, legumes, or a veggie burger for 1 year could prevent the emissions equivalent of driving a gas-powered car almost 700 miles. A vegan meal starring legumes is the most climate-friendly way to eat, said Marco Springman, who studies the emissions impact of the global food system at the University of Oxford. Bonus? Because legumes naturally draw nitrogen from the air into soil, growing them requires less fertilizer and emits fewer greenhouse gases than other crops. If giving up meat at any level sounds daunting, consider reducing the amount of food products you eat from ruminant animals. Cows, bison, sheep, and goats all digest and ferment their food with 4-compartment stomachs in a process called rumination. In cows, this fermentation creates to 50 quarts of plant-warming gas per hour, which cows release through belching. It's no joke. One-third of global methane emissions comes from cows' belches, according to the EPA. That's partly why beef is the single most harmful food to the climate, and it's also why the emissions burden of ruminants is 10 times higher than that of other animals. Consuming 50 grams of protein from eating pork instead of beef means you prevent the emissions equivalent of burning more than 15 pounds of coal. Eating cheese can be worse for the climate than eating some meats, so leaving cheese behind is second only to foregoing beef in its positive climate impact. Cheese production starts with a ruminant animal and requires a lot of milk. Making 2 pounds of cheese emits 2 times more planet-warming gases than processing 2 pounds of poultry does. You can be a fairly unsustainable vegetarian if you eat lots of dairy, Springman said. It's tempting to think that locally raised meat options might prevent the worst of the emissions impact of meat and dairy production. After all, wouldn't it be better to buy a steak from down the road than a bean burger produced halfway across the country? The production of animal-based foods results in so many climate-warming gases that it's hard to offset those climate impacts simply by buying meat and dairy sourced locally, according to Mengui Li and David Robenheimer, who study food system emissions at the University of Sydney. They estimate that prioritizing local food has the potential to reduce emissions from one's diet by only 10%. Localization alone seems to not be enough, Lee said. A shift toward plant-based foods is necessary and more important to ensure a low-emissions diet. If you are trying to further reduce the carbon footprint of even your lowest emissions ingredients, Robenheimer said, locally produced plant-based diets are the answer. Skipping produce that's traveled by long-distance air transport, such as fruits and vegetables that are non-seasonal or exotic to your locale, is the final frontier of sustainable eating. Food system innovations, like giving cows methane-reducing feed supplements and planting cover crops, do show some promise in reducing emissions from animal agriculture. But the potential reductions pale in comparison to the changes we can make together by simply eating fewer animal products. Do we all need to be vegan to save the climate? The answer is probably not, Springman said. But if more people are flexible enough to start replacing meat and dairy, humanity will have a better chance of avoiding the worst of climate change's effects. This afternoon's next article, Biden administration supports removal of 4 dams on the Snake River. Decommissioning the dams is the first step toward restoring salmon runs and respecting native treaties. This article was written by Isabel Whitcomb. The Biden administration today announced its intention to move forward with the removal of 4 controversial dams on Washington's lower Snake River. The long-hoped-for dam removal is necessary for the survival of 13 endangered salmon and steelhead runs, multiple scientific reports and court cases have determined. Native American nations and environmental groups that for decades have advocated for the dam removal applauded the White House move as an essential first step toward restoring salmon and steelhead populations. These dams impact not only our sustenance, but our health, our ability to interact with the land in order to realize our treaty rights, said Chairman Shannon Wheeler of the Nez Perce tribes. The science has become increasingly clear that you are not going to be able to avoid extinction if you do not breach those dams, said Bill Arthur, the chair of the Sierra Club's Snake Columbia River Salmon Campaign. Before the dams were constructed in the 1950s and 60s, millions of salmon and steelhead churned up the Snake River to their spawning water in Idaho's Sawtooth Valley. Since then, populations have plummeted. In 1950, nearly 130,000 wild Chinook salmon made the journey up the river. In 2017, that number was less than 10,000, according to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. During that same time period, wild steelhead declined from around 110,000 to just under 30,000. The dams turn a 140-mile stretch of the Snake River into a series of warm, shallow reservoirs. With nowhere to hide, the salmon are vulnerable to birds and predatory invasive fish. The temperature-sensitive fish also risk overheating. When water temperatures rise above 68 degrees Fahrenheit, the fish begin to die of stress and disease. In 2015, 250,000 adult salmon died in the Columbia and Snake Rivers because of warm water, Just 4% of Snake River sockeye made it over the four lower Snake dams, according to an analysis published by Columbia Waterkeeper. That same analysis found that without the four dams, the river would have remained cool enough for the salmon to survive. Meanwhile, the dams themselves pose a major threat to juvenile fish migrating downstream, said Michael Garrity, an Energy and Water Projects Manager at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Baby fish risk getting thrashed by turbines. You're never going to make a dammed river as safe for juvenile salmon as a free-flowing river, Garrity said. For 20 years, environmental groups and tribes have fought for removal of the dams via a series of lawsuits that challenge the way salmon populations are managed. In all six cases, the courts determined that the salmon recovery plans in place violated the Endangered Species Act and were inadequate for recovery. The recent agreement comes out of more than 2 years of negotiations between the Biden administration and litigants in the most recent lawsuits, which include more than 10 Native American nations led by the Nez Perce tribe and with support from the state of Oregon. A number of factors came together to make this decision possible now, Arthur said. A presidential administration invested in environmental protection and willing to take tribal treaty rights seriously is invaluable, he said. And replacing the power the dams produce, around 4% of the energy used in the Snake River region, has become more feasible as the cost of wind and solar power drops. Finally, attitudes have shifted among the public. In particular, the realization that the decline in salmon runs was negatively impacting southern resident orcas helped garner new public support. A lot of times, the Columbia Basin kind of looks and feels a long ways over there, Arthur said. The orca, for lack of a better phrase, gave us a fish in the fight. Removal of the Lower Snake River dams is not just about following the Endangered Species Act. Decommissioning the dams would also honor native treaty rights. The Treaty of 1859 between the U.S. government and Nez Perce tribe guarantees the tribe exclusive taking of fish running through or bordering its reservation, including in the Snake River and its tributaries. We believe that the Biden administration, congressional leaders, law enforcement, and the courts are all subject to the rule of law, Wheeler said. And the rule of law speaks to what must be done here. If the dam removal proceeds, the proposed agreement still must be approved by Congress. It will be at least several years before the river washes out sediment built up behind the dams, exposing the riverbed, Garrity said. The Biden administration's recent agreement also recommends restoration along the main stem and tributaries of the Snake River. All those actions give the species a real shot, Garrity said. Isabel Whitcomb is a science and environmental journalist based in Portland, Oregon. Their work covering ecology, conservation, and health has appeared in Heike Magazine, Scientific American, Slate, and the New York Times. The next article this afternoon was written by Gordy Slack. The world's second most famous desert pupfish is in trouble. You would not believe the lengths people go to protect these fish. In the middle of the Mojave Desert, one of the hottest and driest places on Earth, is an unlikely blue aquatic jewel of an oasis. Its 24,000 acres have the highest concentration of endemic species in the country. Of those 26 species, a dozen are listed under the Endangered Species Act, and four of those protected desert species are fish. When I visited last spring, the most improbable thing of all was the dripping wet bipedal vertebrate that emerged headfirst from the water wearing a mask and snorkel. What are you doing in there? I called from the boardwalk. Looking for invasive fish, she answered matter-of-factly, and hoping to not find any. The apparition was Emma Prager, an aquatic conservation intern at Nevada's Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge. She was winding up a year-long deployment with a focus on eradicating the green sunfish, an invasive predator. Since 2020, sunfish have been found in alarming numbers in the Crystal Springs system, where they prey on the endangered Ash Meadows Amargosa pupfish, a minnow-sized fish that has lived in Crystal Springs and its outflows for millennia, but whose existence is now imperiled by this much larger, hungry predator. That three of the four endemic species in Ash Meadows managed to survive the past century was itself unlikely, according to Michael Bauer, the refuge manager since 2021. During decades of peat mining and agricultural irrigation, virtually all the area's natural springs and seeps were capped, diverted, channelized, and profoundly degraded, he said. Everything that you can now see from the boardwalks along Crystal Springs used to be concrete irrigation ditches. I still can't explain how our pupfish species made it through the gauntlet of development. Just a little over 2 miles from Crystal Springs lives the Ash Meadows Amargosa pupfish's more famous cousin, the Devil's Hole pupfish, one of the first animals to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. It is possible both the most endangered fish on Earth and the vertebrate with the smallest geographic range, the entire population lives in a single underwater cave. In 1976, the Supreme Court made the Devil's Hole pupfish a controversial celebrity in these parts when its Caparrot versus United States decision ordered the federal government to limit pumping from the region's aquifer to protect the fish's tiny habitat. In Pahrump, the nearest sizable town, there were as many as Kill the Pupfish bumper stickers as Save the Pupfish stickers. Broader protection came in the early 1980s when a proposed 20,000-unit resort development prompted the Nature Conservancy to purchase Ash Meadows and transfer it to the federal government. In 1984, Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge was established. In the four decades since, the irrigation ditches, wells, and pumps have been removed, and natural stream beds restored in much of the refuge. Devil's Hole is completely cut off from the rest of the surface water system, so invasive fish are not typically a problem there. But the Ash Meadows Amargosa pupfish live in pools and seeps that are connected to bodies of water where clueless, well-meaning folks dump unwanted aquarium fish. Which is why Prager was at Crystal Springs hunting sunfish. They come from Crystal Reservoir, 2 miles downstream. For decades, it's been home to bass, green sunfish, crayfish, and other introduced fish that occasionally breach the barriers and make their way into the protected reaches of the system. This happened most recently during the pandemic, when refuge staff were stuck at home and unable to monitor and maintain the fish barriers and traps. By fall 2021, a dangerous number of green sunfish had made their way up into Crystal Springs. With help from Nevada Department of Wildlife and National Park Service staff, Bauer and his team took a multi-front approach. Early on, they tried rod fishing, spear fishing, electrofishing, and hoop netting, carefully measuring the effectiveness of each. The winner was the hoop net, an anchored net funnel leading into an enclosure that green sunfish can swim into but not back out of. The catch peaked at almost 60 in September 2021. When Prager joined in 2022, she checked and emptied the traps at the refuge several times a week. Constant trapping and repairing of the fish barriers worked. In January 2023, the monthly catch was down to 2. When I spotted Prager doing her snorkel survey in late April, she had not caught or even seen a green sunfish for 2 months. Bauer recently won a $12 million federal grant to reclaim Crystal Reservoir and restore the natural outflow of water from Crystal Springs. That will help revive the historic marshlands, a habitat that's too warm and shallow for green sunfish and other invasives to reproduce in. Also in the works here is a backcountry trail, co-designed by the representatives of the Timbisha Shoshone and the Southern Paiute tribes, who consider this desert oasis sacred. They, along with the pupfish, have always considered it home. From the Magazine of the Sierra Club, we have this article, Wildlife Traffickers Reveal Tricks of Their Illegal Trade, Restorative Justice for Traffickers of Rare and Endangered Turtles, written by Maureen O'Hagan. When Wan Zi was growing up in China, he loved turtles. He had 10 species as pets over the years, and they still fascinate him. Box turtles are his favorite, as their shells are almost like art. Eventually, he became something of a turtle expert. In 2015, Zhai Gru moved to the United States to study computer science. He wasn't all that surprised when an acquaintance, a Chinese turtle dealer, approached him with a proposition. Would Zhai help him obtain turtles from the U.S.? As Zhai knew, a lot of the pet turtles in China originate here or in Mexico. The man said Zhai's job would involve posting online ads seeking various types of turtles, buying them, and arranging to have them shipped to another U.S. intermediary. To Zhai, it seemed simple. In China, buying and selling turtles is no big deal. He could use the extra cash, so he figured, why not? The decision pretty much ruined him. All told, he helped the dealer obtain hundreds of turtles from various sellers, approximately 134 Florida box turtles, 178 Eastern box turtles, 127 North American wood turtles, 220 spotted turtles, 77 diamondback terrapins, 25 three-toed box turtles, 7 yellow blotched map turtles, and 1 Blandings turtle. That part was not illegal. But when the turtles were shipped from his then residence in Eugene, Oregon, on their way to their ultimate destination in China, it became a federal wildlife crime. In 2018, Zhai was arrested and charged with conspiracy to smuggle goods out of the U.S. in contravention of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 years of probation, $15,000 in restitution, and 500 hours of community service. He left his computer science program, got divorced, and sank into a deep depression. He's required to stay in the United States until he completes his probation. Once he does, he'll be sent back to China. Assistant U.S. Attorney Pamela Pesso, who handled Zhai's case, said federal prosecutors do not typically get involved in the details of community service. Offenders work that out with their probation officers. But U.S. Fish and Wildlife investigator Paul Monturi wondered if Zhai's knowledge could be turned into a kind of community service. Pesso, in turn, suggested it to the sentencing judge. It was a way, Pesso said, of ensuring the punishment might align more with the crime. So instead of picking up trash on the side of the highway, Zhai is assisting Meredith Gore, a professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Maryland. Using his expertise, he is showing her how wildlife traffickers and buyers connect online and how the market works. The hope is that Gore and others might be able to identify better approaches for prevention. So far, two others convicted of wildlife crimes are also assisting Gore's research. One owned a traditional Chinese herbal shop and sold 30 grams of pangolin scales, the weight of about 12 pennies, to an undercover agent. Another bought, sold, and shipped live scorpions to and from Germany and elsewhere without proper permits. The traffickers, Gore said, become the teachers. For his part, Zhai said the work has given him purpose. Gore was a perfect fit for the pilot project. She calls her work conservation criminology and takes an interdisciplinary approach, looking at everything from natural resource policy to enforcement and human behavior. She first got interested in the practical application of research as an intern working at Defenders of Wildlife in the 1990s. Tasked with organizing scientific papers, she remembered being struck by the disconnect between the researchers in the field and the policymakers on Capitol Hill. Scientists have all this information, and it goes nowhere. It literally goes into a filing cabinet, she said. Throughout her career, Gore has explored issues involving bears in upstate New York, pangolins in Cameroon, and elephants in South Africa. The opportunity to work with the convicted wildlife traffickers presented a new approach. She likens it to restorative justice, which typically involves some form of reconciliation between the offenders and victims. Reconciliation isn't exactly possible in wildlife cases, considering the victims are flora and fauna, so she looks at the restorative aspect in a more expansive way. Maybe there's an opportunity to innovate here and repair harm, not only to an environment or the species, but also to help offenders not do this again, she said. Now, instead of studying computer science, Shai is searching for suspected turtle traffickers online. He knows exactly where to look, primarily Instagram, WeChat, and other social sites. He follows the trends, understanding that a Florida box turtle may be popular one moment and a spotted turtle the next. I could find turtles for sale every day, every hour, he said. Shai documents each contact in a report, including the seller's web address, the species, the price, and other details. Then he sends it off to Gore. He definitely knows a lot more about it than I do, and as a result, I can do my science better, she said. What I see bubbling to the top is, these are people that actually care about wildlife, she said. There's this idea that the traffickers do not care about the animals, but the offenders I'm working with know a lot about the animals, and I think they do want to help. That's all the time we have this afternoon. Thank you for joining us for the December 27th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.